Hello, I'm Julian Bergini, and welcome to the last of four podcasts exploring the relationship and tensions between hierarchy and equality. They've been made in association with the Berggruen Institute's Philosophy and Culture Centre, the goal of which is to develop fresh ideas through comparative and interdisciplinary work and relate these insights to the pressing issues of our day. Today's podcast is an unlikely pairing of medieval Islamic philosophy and Friedrich Nietzsche. In many ways, these couldn't be more different, but as we'll see, they both provide challenges to modern Western egalitarian ideals. Discussing these issues with me were Carlos Frankel, who's James McGill Professor of Philosophy and Jewish Studies at McGill University in Montreal, and the author of Philosophical Religions from Plato to Spinoza, Reason, Religion and Autonomy, and Matthias Rieser, Professor of Philosophy and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and the author of Global Political Philosophy. I began by asking Carlos Frankel whether he really thought that the paternalistic hierarchical ideas of the Falsafa Islamic tradition can actually be used to promote rational autonomy.
Yeah, that's right. So it seems paradoxical, but that's indeed my claim, that one of the main aims of what I call divine law paternalism in this medieval tradition is to maximize rational autonomy. That seems somewhat implausible to us at first, but you know, one can make a good case for that. We were brought up in a Western liberal democracy, we're sort of by default egalitarians, we have to somehow go to China or to Nietzsche or to the Middle Ages to find positions that actually challenge our egalitarian assumptions. And in a certain way, these medieval philosophers do that because they do argue for a position that strikes us as morally pernicious, namely paternalism, right, where people consider it legitimate that some people rule others and interfere with their autonomy, maybe even coercively. But the more I studied their project, the less unattractive it sort of appeared to me, precisely because I saw that they're very concerned with maximizing rational autonomy, which I think is something that we also can relate to.
They value rational autonomy. What gets in the way of our rational autonomy?
Yeah, so I think the main problem is that we are imperfectly rational agents. And I think they take that to be a kind of a part of the human condition, as it were. So it's not possible to correct that. Even the best education system cannot transform us into perfectly rational agents. And in order to be perfectly rational, autonomous, you have to be a perfectly rational agent. You have to have perfect knowledge of what is right. And that's something that is unattainable according to them, because I think that this kind of knowledge is so vast and complex that one cannot really master it. But at the same time, to think that you can attain rational autonomy by degree. So the fact that we cannot be perfectly rationally autonomous does not entail that we cannot be rationally autonomous at all, but we can be imperfectly rationally autonomous. And that's what they sort of aim to achieve.
Now, so, but having divine law paternalism, as you put it, help us to do that? Presumably it's about trying to sort of close the gap between
right.
our imperfect knowledge and perfect knowledge
right.
by accepting some kind of what, divine authority?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, the concept of divine law seems to us to directly contradict the idea of autonomy, right? So not we are in charge, but God is in charge. Not we make the rules, but God makes the rules. So it really seems that we are not autonomous at all. We have to submit to God or to the prophet or the religious leaders who, convey God's will. And so it seems really unintuitive to claim that it's actually promotes rational autonomy. But I think the basic idea is, so they conceive the prophet as a kind of very accomplished philosopher who has a firm grasp of the good, but he's not only a philosopher, he's also something like a good popularizer of science. He's capable of giving people sort of a picture of the universe and their place in the universe, their place in the social world, which allows them to then act in a way that is determined by reasons. And so in the end, the communication of the prophet really is provides a kind of rational conceptual framework that allows people to make the right decisions on their own once they have grasped that framework.
Is that an idea which is completely alien to the kind of tradition that you work in, Matthias? Or is there some correlates to this? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, Kant's idea of autonomy is at the same time an idea of submission to a law which is outside ourselves, isn't it?
It is a very alien thought, actually. So if you think about the Enlightenment project, and this is now sufficiently broadly conceived to actually range from Rousseau via Kant then all the way to Nietzsche, what these guys all have in common is that morality or any kind of duties come from within ourselves. So they are expressions of a self properly understood.
I mean, Carlos was saying one of the reasons for looking at these ideas is to sort of provide some challenge and shake us up. And isn't part of the challenge of this that actually, you know, this desire to find everything within yourself is doomed? I mean, Nietzsche, you talked about, would agree that we're very far from perfectly rational.
No, but then, so the contrast here between the Enlightenment views broadly conceived and those views that they were up against is that the Enlightenment views are autonomy focused and the views they're up against are all about the guidance is coming from an external source. So the what's both exciting and paradoxical about the view that Carlos is bringing into the discussion is that referring to the outside source is autonomy enhancing, and that is playing a bit of a trick on the move tree here.
Mm-hmm. Is it a trick?
I mean, in a certain way, you could say that the ideal of the Enlightenment project, namely a community of, you know, perfectly rational agents who are self-legislating, just follow the instructions or the prescriptions of their own reason, is an ideal that the medieval philosophers share, but they think it's unattainable given the reality of human nature. And so it becomes something like a regulative ideal, so they try to approach the real human communities as much as possible to it, but they try to somehow incorporate as much as possible into the real communities, but they think that it cannot be fully achieved. And I think one of the main differences between the medieval philosophers and the variety of Enlightenment thinkers is that they don't have this concept of intellectual cultural progress, right? That human beings are somehow perfectible, right? This idea that that human beings may not have been perfectly rational always, but that over time, that history in some kind of teleological way works itself towards this kind of perfect community.
But that of course exactly is the hallmark of the Enlightenment and the contrast,
right.
That, I mean, it's not confined to the Enlightenment, but in a way this is the departure from the Middle Ages, that more stock is being put into individual judgment, that individuals actually really have the capacity of thinking for themselves.
But isn't it the case, though, that increasingly people are skeptical about that Enlightenment ambition? And now, in fact, it's sort of like quite fashionable to dismiss it. So given that, ought we to be looking at alternatives to that, you know, finding ways of accepting our limitations and giving up what a lot of people would say the illusion that we can move towards this perfectibility and create this progress?
I think in part it depends on what we think moral autonomy requires, right? So the medieval philosophers think that you have to somehow understand the universe as a whole in order to be morally autonomous. So you have to understand both the natural order and, actually, in addition to that, also the social order. And that, of course, is a very high demand. But if you don't share that view, as Kant does not, for example, then you might be able to make a case for the possibility of moral autonomy where you don't have to satisfy this very high demand. But if you do share that view that actually in order to be autonomous rational agents we have to understand everything pretty much, then you might become quite skeptical about the possibility of rational, of perfect rational autonomy.
Final question on this one for you, Carlos. If we don't have the idea that we have any access to divine law and we can sort of plug the gap between our own limitations and the way we should be through that, what use is this idea to us?
I finished high school in 1990 when the Soviet bloc was somehow collapsing. And you know, like many people, I had the sense at the time that somehow secular and liberal Western values and attitude would somehow spread around the world. And like many people, I now think that that's not going to be anytime soon. And I think there's now this sort of a concept of a post-secular world. And I think there's some evidence for that. We live in a world in which religions continue to thrive and be vital. And so I think we will have to somehow engage with a lot of people for whom the divine law continues being something important. And the way these medieval philosophers try to deploy the divine law, try to co-opt it for their kind of Enlightenment project, if you want to call it that, I think remains interesting because so many people still follow divine law, right? And so some of these strategies that they have developed might still come in handy because the kind of you know, militant Enlightenment attitude doesn't seem to have much purchase in a lot of people. You know, these kind of militant sort of neo-Enlightenment atheists, you know, they're very loud, but religious people don't listen to them. And so some of these strategies that the medieval philosophers developed might actually still be interesting.
Well, I mean, Matthias, turning to what you were talking about and Nietzsche, and you were pointing out that people might be surprised or doubt that Nietzsche has a theory of justice, but he does have an idea of justice.
Nietzsche is a deeply non-religious thinker, a deeply non-egalitarian thinker. He thinks that all the egalitarian coloring that many people associate with justice these days is a product of a very misguided historical process where Christianity played a major role. So a lot of people think of justice and they have these ideas about inherent human dignity that everybody has equally, and Nietzsche wants none of that. So Nietzsche emphasizes the enormous range of differences among human beings. He says we just all are very different. Very few of us display any kind of serious capacity to accomplishment. Very few of us display the form of excellence that humanity is capable of. And his message really is rather crude, that societies should be organized around these people. And that everybody else should just make their peace with the fact that life is not about them. And the notion of justice that accompanies this view is that everybody should be treated in accordance with their human capacities. And again, only in very few cases will this mean a lot of capacities.
One of the sort of challenging views of that is the way in which it does undermine this ideal that humans are equal in a fundamental sense, which, as you say, he claims is a distinctly Christian idea. Now, is it the case that it's an idea which has its roots in Christianity or actually fundamentally depends upon a Christian idea of being equal under the eyes of God in order for it to be maintained?
Well, of course, that's a much debated question among philosophers. So Nietzsche's point is both, right? So he thinks that this is an idea that has crept up, certainly in the Western context, only in the Christian context. So this wasn't part of the ancient world. Christianity put in the seeds of a framework that eventually would lead to egalitarian thinking. I say put in the seeds because, of course, Christianity itself has displayed hugely egalitarian tendencies. The Catholic Church is not exactly a massive diachronic movement for equality. But the idea that every human being is created in the image of God, that is a starting point for more egalitarian demands. So in that sense, Nietzsche thinks it comes into our intellectual context through Christianity. It has no other way of coming into the European context through Christianity. But then it also it throws the Christian starting point throws a long shadow. So why are Kantian ethicists, why are utilitarians, why are so many secular people who decidedly do not think of themselves as doing theological work or even being theologically inspired, why are they advocating ideas of equality? Well, Nietzsche thinks they're ultimately undermined. They are penetrated by intuitions that have their origin in Christianity, and they haven't fully realized that. So indeed, both. So the origins are within Christianity. All the views that are defending views of equality somehow and other, subconsciously, as it were, get them from Christianity. And once we have cleansed these views of their Christian origins, there is, according to Nietzsche, nothing we can say to support them.
It's actually interesting that the medieval philosophers like Nietzsche are non-egalitarians, right? So they are not committed, they're clearly not committed to this principle of, you know, a fundamental moral equality of human beings, but they are perfectionists and they think that there are different degrees of excellence and, you know, a person's value depends on how excellent he or she becomes, what degree of excellence he or she achieves. And they actually do tie that to an interpretation of precisely the passage in the Bible that Nietzsche thinks is somehow, you know, the source of all evil, this idea that human beings are created in the image of God. And so for the medieval Jewish philosopher Maimonides, for example, being created in the image of God is not a given, but it's an achievement. being created in the image of God is something that you actually have to achieve. You have to actualize your intellect by learning all these sciences. And he describes people who do not perfect their intellect as actually animals. You know, they look like human beings, but in terms of their moral status, they're actually subhuman.
And yet the medieval mind also itself produces ideas that in the overall scheme of things, one can connect to the later coming to greater fruition of egalitarian ideas, namely specifically the right, there's this famous right of necessity. So right of necessity, we are all entitled as human beings to, in cases of emergency, to take for ourselves what it takes to survive. And why is that an entitlement? Well, it's the divine nature that lives in all of us that generates this. And of course, that by itself, a right of necessity, is a far cry from a full-fledged idea of equality. But that illustrates my earlier point that there's the Christian outlook, and there's the seed of egalitarian thinking that comes from this idea of creation in the divine image. That, of course, there's also countervailing tendencies, and they have been dominant for much of the time, but that's what a tradition is, right? You have a body of thought, some bunch of ideas to work with, and they have been combined in very different ways in different periods.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Nietzsche's view is a very kind of bleak one, a very sort of unpleasant one, unsavory one to a lot of people. But you think that we could accept his certain premises, we could accept the fact that not all humans are equal in capacity or even worth in ranking, but that doesn't entail the rebarbative conclusion that therefore we have to treat people in hugely different ways. So how do you square that? How do you manage to avoid the horrible conclusion of Nietzsche's premises?
The one reason why Nietzsche is of such great interest to me is because he is right in a lot of the cultural analysis, the historical analysis about how we ended up with certain moral views about the relevance of Christianity. All that I think is right, and I think it is important for philosophy to think about the foundations of any kind of views, including notions of moral equality, in a way that is cleansed of these ideas. And I think that is an important project also, because I disagree with Carlos that it's important to somehow keep religion in the running. I think it is very healthy for the world to get rid of religion as much as we can. So
I wasn't saying that we should preserve religion. It was more a statement of fact. It seems that religion is not going.
Okay. But so be that as it may. So Nietzsche is right in giving us this clarion call and saying, look, you really have to be aware how much you have been penetrated by highly problematic religious views. Does this mean that we have to go his own way? Does this mean that we actually have to embrace this view that there is, for one thing, that there is these massive differences among human beings, and then secondly that societies should be organized in such a way that they are responsive to that, so that the excellent human beings get their run of the field and everybody else should just be dancing around them. So that's that second step that I would then disagree with. Two quick ways of articulating that. For one thing, Nietzsche himself has this idea that we need to translate human beings back into nature. We need to remove the transcendental world, the otherworldliness that Christianity has utilized in order to formulate its theology. He thinks we should translate human beings back into nature, understand them as products of evolution. And I think if you do that, and I think it's quite right to insist on that, what you will discover is that there is a distinctively human life. There is a human brain that has evolved over in the course of evolution that has given us as human beings an amazing range of abilities as individuals, but in particular and also to do things together. And it's this distinctively human life that makes us so truly awesome as the outcomes of evolution, and it makes us awesome in ways that we can formulate just fine without going to any kind of theological framework. So Nietzsche is right in the analysis, but then he is wrong in his low esteem for many human beings. And the other way of resisting this Nietzsche's highly egalitarian conclusions is also to point out that one could grant to Nietzsche even a fair amount of what he says about the range of human excellence that's present in people. But then the question is, how operative should this be in society? And there I would say actually very little, because we have to acknowledge that in spite of all the anthropological diversity, human beings live together in certain political and economic structures. And within these political and economic structures, everybody has a role to play. Everybody makes some kind of contribution. Everybody is expected to play by the rules. There is enormous and immediate sanctions if you're not playing by the rules. And so we live in a social world that is created by all of us together, that is made possible by our willingness to cooperate with other people. And because of that, everybody has a claim against the rest of us that the social world be arranged in such a way that it makes sense to each one of them. And surely one way in which it does not make sense for a lot of people if the organizing principle is that we are all organized around these few people displaying human excellence. So the idea that all of us who maintain social structures should agree to a principle like that is just insane. And the rebuttal to Nietzsche's point there really comes from acknowledging the fact that it requires a lot of intense cooperation and rule compliance of a lot of people to make our social lives possible.
And in that sense, there's a more of a plurality of values, if you like, that someone's value, that they may be compared to the Uber mentioned, very limited in their capacities, but they may be a very decent person, a very helpful person, someone who's very necessary socially. Yeah.
So the Übermensch, any kind of the famous word, of course, that Nietzsche occasionally uses, he has a number of terms that he uses to describe this embodiment of human excellence, but their excellence can unfold in society only if everybody else is kind of going along with that and makes it possible. And so the idea that we are all participants in the social structure really has a priority here, because it enables everybody within the structure to actually do what they are doing. And because of that, everybody who's in the structure actually has a claim, again, against everybody else, that structure makes sense to them. We really do this together. We're in this together.
Well, two very different perspectives, but I suppose what they have in common is that they both challenge the kind of view that we base our fundamental fairness in society on, a straightforward view that we all have equal capacities and we also have the individual capacities to be fully autonomous and moral without any other kind of resources. So it may seem an unlikely combination of ideas, but there's perhaps something that brings it together. So thank you both very much.
That was the last in the recent mini-series on philosophy East and West. There are 9 other episodes in the archive to explore on the themes of self, harmony and freedom, and hierarchy and equality. To find out about future podcasts as soon as they are available, subscribe to the Microphilosophy iTunes feed or follow me on Twitter at Microphilosophy. And do check out the work of the Berggruen Institute's Philosophy and Culture Centre at philosophyandculture.berggruen.org. So until next time, if nothing prevents, goodbye.